Although it would not be clear for another 3 months, David Marshall's resignation brought an end to Singapore's most liberal period and the end of the brief flowering of democratic associationalism. His term lasted only 14 months, but his impact was profound and long-lasting. He embedded the principles of liberalism and democracy into the political process and established constitutional and governmental practices that continue to the current day. And most importantly, he fundamentally changed the perception of self-government from a distant ideal to imminently achievable. Suddenly, people realized self-government was coming. Independence was coming. And because of this, winter was coming. Because this realization changed Singapore's politics. Once the British left, who would rule Singapore? Who would sit on the Iron Throne? Real power was now suddenly up for grabs, and over the next 7 years, Singapore would see a Game of Thrones. Sadly, this real Game of Thrones was no less violent and bloody than the fictional one. People would get killed, lives would be destroyed, innocents would fall victim to cruel politics. Violence, greed, murder. That was Singapore politics from 1956 to 1963. Let's set the scene. Following his failure to win self-government for Singapore at the 1956 constitutional talks in London, David Marshall resigned. Lim Yew Hock later succeeded Marshall as chief minister, but it was Lee Kuan Yew who gained the most from the events of London. As I mentioned last week, Lee spent more time in meetings with British politicians, lobbying for support, seeking to build friendships and alliances, than he did meeting with his own delegation. Lee aimed to promote himself to the British as a viable future collaborator and to dispel any idea that he was a tool of the communists. And it worked. Lee returned to Singapore greatly enhanced in British eyes. "Lee Kuan Yew made a great impact," recalled Colonial Secretary Alan Lennox Boyd in an interview many years later. Quote, "What was clearly emerging by this time was Lee Kuan Yew, who was obviously first-class political material," unquote, remembered Governor Black in another interview. "Lee Kuan Yew is Singapore's rising politician," wrote The Observer at the time. Internal British memoranda show a sudden increased confidence in him, his anti-communist credentials, and his ability to defeat the PAP left. This is the moment when the British really start considering Lee as a genuine option for the future leadership of Singapore. Back in London, Lim Chin Siong and Lee Kuan Yew had bitterly disagreed about whether to accept the deal offered by the British. On his return, Lim Chin Siong sat down with the PAP left wing. They were unhappy with Lee's self-promotion and his undermining of the delegation. The enemy was the British. The enemy was colonialism. Now was not the time to argue between themselves. Independence first, then politics later. But Lee Kuan Yew would not listen. So, how could they restrain Lee and his followers? Lim Chin Siong urged for unity with other anti-colonial forces. He explored a broad left-wing alliance by perhaps retaining David Marshall or promoting Deputy Chief Minister Abdul Hamid bin Jumat as Chief Minister. Hamid proposed a coalition of the left-leaning UMNO Singapore leadership, the left-wing Labour Front and the PAP left-wing to form a stable coalition that mirrored the Federation's right-wing alliance. But Lim Chin Siong didn't want to break up the PAP, and Lee Kuan Yew and PAP Chairman Toh Chin Chai refused to cooperate. Instead, Lee actively lobbied the Labour Front and UMNO leadership to choose Lim Yew Hock over Hamid Jumat for the chief ministership. He dismissed Hamid Jumat's suitability for leadership. Governor Black noted how this, quote, "underlines the divergence of policy and disunity within the PAP," unquote. It also infuriated Hamid Jumat, who had stood up for Lee and the PAP against UMNO Singapore's right wing, helping overcome initial Malay distrust of Lee. Disgusted of Lee's betrayal, he declared to Black that UMNO is now, quote, "anti-PAP as well as anti-communist," unquote. Meanwhile, Samad Ismail and Devan Nair, both of the PAP left, proposed a closer association between the Middle Road Unions and the PAP, which would serve to restrain Lee Kuan Yew and the PAP right wing. The PAP was reliant on the unions, not the other way around. For Lee Kuan Yew and his followers to abandon the unions would be tantamount to suicide. That was how they could restrain Lee's irresponsible self-promotion, by controlling the grassroots. As I mentioned in the last episode, it was clear that to succeed in Singapore politics, to pressure for change, and indeed to win an election, you need to mobilize a large grassroots movement. And really, there was only one force in Singapore that really had that strength. The Middle Road Group of Unions, led by Lim Chin Siong's Singapore Factory and Shopworkers Union. Lim Yew Hock's Singapore Trades Union Congress had the structure, but they were smaller, less motivated, led by leaders who were less capable and far more self-interested and self-promotional. But Governor Black felt that if he could convince Lee Kuan Yew and Lim Yew Hock to work together, they could build a coalition to defeat the PAP left. Black understood the necessity of grassroots politics and so predicted a, quote, struggle between Lim Yew Hock and PAP left wing for leadership of a united national front. And in this struggle, the support of the right wing of the PAP will be of great importance, unquote. Accordingly, Black sought to drive a wedge between the left and right wings of the PAP. He aimed to calm down the situation to allow the Lim Yew Hock government to settle in and develop public confidence, but also to prevent any events which, quote, might well do much to heal the breach between the two wings of the PAP, unquote. And Lim Yew Hock, of course, was happy to collude with Lee Kuan Yew against the PAP left. Encouraged by Black, Lim Yew Hock and Lee Kuan Yew would actively, but not openly, secretly work with and try and use and manipulate each other over the next year and a half against their common enemy. So these are your players. The Five Kingdoms. On the PAP right, Lee Kuan Yew. On the PAP left, Lim Chin Siong, Devan Nair and Samad Ismail. For the Labour Front, Lim Yew Hock. For UMNO Singapore, Hamid Jumat. And the wild card, still a member of the Legislative Assembly, still out there, David Marshall. And then the other powers, the king beyond the causeway, Tunku Abdul Rahman. The Iron Bank of Bravos, global capital and finance, which had, and still has, a massively influential role in Singapore. And looming above everyone, with reserve powers like Dragonfire, Colonial Secretary Alan Lennox Boyd and Governor Robert Black. And the prize, the Iron Throne, the Istana of independent Singapore. Whoever said Singapore history was boring, you couldn't be more wrong. This is a Game of Thrones. Hey, do you mind? I'm trying to record my podcast here.
Sorry.
Anyway, hello and welcome to the History of Singapore. Episode 29, Game of Thrones. Even as the repercussions for the 1956 constitutional talks were still reverberating, thoughts were already turning to the 1957 constitutional talks. Lennox Boyd had already indicated his willingness to reopen talks in 1957. And so, public discussion centred on how to avoid a recurrence of the disunity that sundered the delegation. The only sensible path was for the parties to thrash out all their differences and negotiate an agreement beforehand. At his first press conference as chief minister, Lim Yew Hock stated that this would be his chief priority. But behind the scenes, discussion centred not so much on finding a common position as fixing the outcome ahead of time and getting rid of opponents. Lim Yew Hock and Lee Kuan Yew privately negotiated a mutually acceptable basic position, which was internal self-government, with the British retaining control over external security and external affairs, and the British and the Federation governments retaining the right to intervene in internal security. Governor Black endorsed this position to his bosses, noting to Alan Lennox Boyd that it also supported the British long-term aim of reunifying Singapore with the Federation. Black was also exhausted by David Marshall's non-stop push for constitutional progress, and he desired time to resolve issues previously thought they had plenty of time for, but now which seemed very pressing, issues which would need to be resolved before independence, such as the Malayanization of the civil service, they needed time to recruit and train up locals to take over while finding the money to compensate British colonial civil servants for their early departure. In late July 1956, Lim Yew Hock returned to London for the Commonwealth Labour Administration Conference and took the opportunity to meet with Colonial Secretary Allan Lennox Boyd. On 24th July, Lennox Boyd and John Hare, the Minister of State for the Colonies, met with Lim Yew Hock for a long talk on Singapore's constitutional future and what Lim needed to do for the British to grant concessions. Thanks to a declassified document from the British Archives, we can create almost exactly what was said in the meeting. Lennox Boyd: "What you do during the next few crucial months in this field will influence my colleagues and I in our eventual decision. You must be tough with the Chinese Middle School Students Union." Emphasizing the subversive potential of the Chinese School Students Union, Lennox Boyd pressed on, "We fear that the Chinese primary schools might go the way of the middle schools. You must rally active support and carry out positive measures against these subversive groups." Lim Yew Hock replied, "Once there is a political solution, particularly in regard to a Malayan Governor General, I will be in a position to take stronger measures." Lennox Boyd refused. "This is really not good enough. I want earnest signs of positive measures in the field of education." Lim Yew Hock: "I know what to do and how to do it. I don't suppose you would approve of the means. If you tell the governor to give me a free hand and for the police to do what I said, everything will be all right." Lennox Boyd: "I have a fairly supple conscience in this field." The message from Lennox Boyd was clear. He wanted the student movement crushed. That was his condition for self-government. Why was this man sitting in London, in charge of administrating an entire British empire, so terrified of students in Singapore? Let's take a step back and catch up with what had been going on with the anti-colonial movement. You see, throughout 1956, the anti-colonial movement had been steadily consolidating. From late 1955 onwards, once the easy gains were made and government countermeasures took effect, left-wing associationalism suffered increasing reversals. Their attempts to influence colonial policy in critical areas failed. Growth in the labour movement slowed sharply. As I mentioned, there were many areas which David Marshall couldn't impact, especially the areas which were still under British control. But the frustrations of the anti-colonial movement were in stark contrast to the success of Malay associationalism. As with Chinese education, the colonial government had sought to impose English language education on Malay language schools in 1952. UMNO Singapore had remained silent on the issue, leading the Malay community to independently form the Malay Education Council in July 1955 to independently lobby for change. They wrote to the new Minister for Education, Chew Swee Kee, demanding the alteration of the present Malay education system to one broadly on Chinese educational lines, Chinese middle school lines, with Malay as the sole medium of instruction, and the establishment of a Malay university. And Chew Swee Kee responded in the same way that he did towards the Chinese educationalists. He agreed in principle, but then deflected them with a series of half-measures and minor compromises that didn't really change anything. The Malay educational community initially tried the same tactics as the Chinese, threatening boycotts and holding demonstrations, but these led nowhere, as it did with the Chinese. What eventually succeeded was political pressure in a competitive political system. The Malay Education Council took advantage of the competition within UMNO Singapore to push its agenda by supporting candidates who were pro-reform. This led UMNO to threaten to resign from the government if the Malay Education Council's demands were not met, and this would cause the coalition government to collapse. Chew Swee Kee quickly gave way. In November 1956, a new education policy restoring Malay as the medium of instruction throughout Malay schools was passed. The left-wing anti-colonial movement drew three conclusions from their failure and the success of the Malay Education Council. The first was the need for unity. The trade union movement was fragmented between five formal federations dominated by the Singapore Trades Union Congress and the Middle Road Group. The strength of the movement was being dissipated, fighting each other, and employers and the government were exploiting divisions. Little progress would be made unless a way could be found to unify their strength and present a broad-based coalition to oppose the government. Left-wing unity became a repeated theme of Lim Chin Siong's speeches, and the Middle Road Group sought unity within the Singapore Trades Union Congress. The left-wing movement also reached out across linguistic boundaries. A worried Governor Black observed an expansion of anti-colonial associational activity throughout Singapore, especially among Malays. The PAP, the Singapore Chinese Middle School Students' Union, and the trade unions were offering Malay classes. PAP and Singapore Chinese Middle School Student Union members were actively supporting the Malay Education Council campaign, and the University of Malaya Socialist Club began publishing a Malay edition of Fajar. The second conclusion was that the left-wing movement had to act more proactively and with greater sophistication. Thus far, the left had been fighting defensively, seeking to protect their rights. In their petitions, they would, quote, request the government to do away with discriminatory colonial regulations, unquote, and, quote, to give freedom of speech, publication and association, and to safeguard the rights of cultural workers, and to protest against the suppression of legitimate activities. But the government would simply ignore them or just pay lip service to these principles. And people had enough of this. If the government was not going to respect its own laws, its own rhetoric of freedom, then the movement would have to take freedom from them. And so, as the left-wing movement gained experience and sophistication, it began to seize the initiative from the government. The aim of the cultural movement shifted from defending Chinese rights to attacking the moral authority of the colonial authorities to decide what was quote-unquote undesirable and quote-unquote subversive, and to decide the content of Malayan identity. The new Singapore Women's Federation, founded by the indomitable Linda Cheng Mong Hock, or Cheng Meng He, as well as the left-wing trade unions, joined the cultural campaign. They attacked the colonial state's hypocrisy in allowing obscene or violent forms of Western culture while simultaneously condemning all Chinese culture, even pre-communist, as subversive. The use of detention without trial was connected with the suppression of cultural heritage while at the same time allowing yellow, as in unhealthy, culture to flourish. So, in essence, colonial rule suppresses Confucian classics while encouraging British pornography and violence. This is immoral. Colonial rule, therefore, is immoral. We must get rid of colonial rule. Of course, the colonial authorities immediately branded this movement as another communist front attempt to infiltrate organizations concerned with the publication of all forms of literature and by eventual domination to impose its own censorship. Singapore Colonial Secretary William Goode condemned it for, quote, using a moral issue for political ends, unquote. But Governor Black worried that communists had found an issue of broad appeal to non-communists that the government could not easily oppose. So they supported the Liberal Socialist, the right-wing Liberal Socialist Party's attempt to organize a competing moral uplift movement, organized on identical but right-wing lines, but this did not gain much traction. The third and most important conclusion was that the anti-colonial movement had insufficient influence on politics. The Malay Education Council had achieved its goals largely by influencing a critical part of the governing coalition. The labour movement in particular would have to play a larger, more direct role in politics. This was widely perceived as a positive and natural evolution. The Sin Chew Jit Po in particular published a series of articles about the labour history in the UK and USA. It argued that the Singapore labour movement had gone as far as it could while remaining on the periphery of the political sphere, and the move towards more direct political involvement was a quote-unquote natural tendency. Like the UK Labour Party, or the AFL-CIO in the USA, the trade union movement had to get directly involved with politics if they wanted to effect change. Thus, in July 1956, when the PAP held its third party conference, Lim Chin Siong and Devan Nair both stood for the Central Executive Committee and were elected with the highest and fourth highest number of votes respectively. Other newcomers to the CEC were trade unionist Chia Ek Tien, Harun bin Kasim, who was elected deputy chairman, and Goh Boon Toh, along with lawyer T.T. Raja. The CEC now had enough left-wing and independently-minded members to ensure that Lee Kuan Yew and Toh Chin Chai were, quote, now unable to move without consulting a shadow cabinet which includes Devan Nair and Lim Chin Siong, unquote. That's Governor Robert Black reporting. Special Branch felt that Lee and Toh could only count on party treasurer Ong Eng Guan, lawyer Tan Wee Tiong, and possibly Ismail Rahim for votes. So, going back to Lim Yew Hock in London. As Lennox Boyd sat there across from Lim Yew Hock, he was aware of the expansion of anti-colonialism in Singapore and worried about it. The Malay Education Council had made significant gains in the field of education, had defeated government policy by getting directly involved in politics, and the rest of the anti-colonial movement was learning from this. Lennox Boyd was aware of this growth and increasing sophistication and increasing political participation of the left-wing anti-colonial movement. And he needed the Singapore government to cut out the heart of the Chinese cultural movement before it duplicated Malay success and on a much bigger scale, and before it could then breed greater success for the anti-colonial movement in the labour and political arenas. And that's why step one, crush the most passionate and most intellectual component of the cultural movement, the base of the cultural movement, the thought in the British side, the cause of public opinion turning against British brutality in 1954, the Singapore Chinese Middle School Students' Union. But they couldn't simply just go in and beat up an unarmed student group and shoot dissidents. They needed a way to justify it. How? Stay tuned. Welcome back. Before Lim Yew Hock left for London in July 1956, he told Governor Black that, quote, he was willing to take a strong line of the Chinese school students if he could secure a vote of confidence at the next meeting of the Assembly, unquote. And so, on his return to Singapore, Lim set about obtaining this vote of confidence. The Legislative Assembly reconvened on 29th August. The Governor's address, setting out the programme of the new government, emphasize a grab bag of economic issues, with only a cursory reference made to, quote, the early attainment of complete internal self-government, unquote. But, the press agreed, the overriding criterion on which the government would be judged would be the attainment of self-government. Marshall had raised the bar. The expectations of the people were that Lim would keep fighting for the freedom of Singapore, following the trail blazed by David Marshall. But, of course, at a slower pace, slowly building consensus first. The disunity that had undermined the delegation in London had to be avoided. They had to solve that problem before they could go back to London. As he had planned, Lim declared the vote on the governor's address to be a vote of confidence in his government. Lim promised to call for a national convention to plan the tactics for the next talk. But he also declared that, quote, a new strategy is called for as a result of experience gained over the failure of the last talks, unquote, without specifying what his new strategy would be. After 2 days of debate, Lim's motion to approve the governor's address passed unanimously. Armed with this endorsement, he could argue that the Legislative Assembly had endorsed his position. And so he proceeded to run riot over everyone's expectations. Well, everyone except Lee Kuan Yew, of course. In preparation, the Council of Ministers had asked Special Branch to prepare a basis for targeted arrests and dissolutions of key associations. The problem for Special Branch was they had no basis on which to justify arrests. They had no evidence. Indeed, all the evidence pointed the other way, that the MCP in Singapore had been reduced to a bunch of bumbling individuals acting at cross purposes from each other. Let's catch up with what the MCP has been up to for the last few years. So it must be stressed that Special Branch sincerely believed in the continued existence of MCP conspiracy. They believed in the continued strength of the MCP in Singapore. Throughout this period, their reports repeatedly estimated an MCP, a Malayan Communist Party with around 20 members, leading 200 active sympathizers and followed by 2,000 passive sympathizers. I think these numbers are kind of suspiciously round. These reports describe an MCP divided into four branches. So you have the Town and Rural Committee, you have an A branch, E branch, and a propaganda unit which published Freedom Press. However, evidence from interrogation of arrested communist leaders and seized documents paint a picture of a few scattered individuals, unable to contact each other, hunted by the police, acting without direction and on their own initiative. A November 1952 report noted that, quote, apart from Freedom Press, there is no other MCP organization on the island, unquote. MCP leaders Yu Choi Yip and George Ho fled to Riau in around July or August 1953. Then their successor in Singapore, Lam Wai Ying, was arrested in October 1953. Her successor, Wan Fung, was arrested 21st January 1954. Comrade D, alias Ng Ming Chiang, took over, but his chief lieutenants, Sam Kung and Tie Fung, were both arrested in June 1954. So you can see the Special Branch were knocking them over even as new ones popped up. And reports captured with them bemoaned a lack of money, supporters or capacity and pleaded with the MCP leaders in the Federation for more human and material support. But none came. But their worst enemy was themselves. Comrade D's leadership was a disaster. He was inconsistent, he departed from party directives, and as I've mentioned in previous episodes, was constantly surprised by events like the National Service protest and the Hock Lee bus strike. Comrade D's erratic leadership, and even more so, his philandering among his comrades' girlfriends, destroyed the little solidarity that remained among the party. Aside from the incompetent Comrade D, there were only two other MCP members left in Singapore. Wu Chong Po had quarrelled with Tie Fung in 1952 and departed to start his own branch called A Branch. After struggling fruitlessly for a year, he gave up, he retired, he married his courier, and they settled down to a quiet existence. Special Branch finally found him living quietly with his wife and two children in 1959. He was a farmer. Meanwhile, Fong Chong Pik, or Fang Chong Pi, continued to lead the propaganda division. But his job was printing Freedom News, and that explicitly precluded active participation in any subversive activity. In 1958, Comrade D would be quietly withdrawn by Yu Choi Yip, leaving Fong or Fang Chong Pi in sole command. Fang then, of course, would later be called the Plenipotentiary or the Plen by Lee Kuan Yew. But the thing is, Yu Choi Yip withdrew Comrade D without Central Committee permission. Chin Peng, the leader of the MCP, later objected to this when he found out, because Comrade D was a Politburo member, but it was already done. So even the Singapore Town Committee was working at cross purposes with the Federation leadership. And so, as anti-colonial activity increased throughout 1955 to 56, Special Branch remained convinced that the MCP would eventually be revealed to be behind it all, despite all evidence to the contrary. Their reports estimated inflated numbers, with no evidence to substantiate their claims. To this day, of course, former MCP members will continue to insist that they did play a major role in the independence of Singapore, in the decolonization, anti-colonial movement. But they suffer from the same problem that Special Branch did in the 50s. There's no evidence. I think there's an interesting academic article here about the internal brain, the groupthink of Special Branch, and how they could convince themselves. Perhaps they wanted an MCP as an SD to exist as an enemy. But how could they get it so badly wrong, despite having all the evidence in their own files, in their own reports? For example, an April 1956 report declared that A Branch was quote, believed to consist of at least 300 to 400 people, including a group of 16 full party members, divided into three units to infiltrate students, labourers and shop assistants, unquote. In reality, as they later found out in 59, it existed entirely in the imagination of one quietly retired MCP member, Wu Chong Po, who had given up the struggle in 53. So, all evidence indicates that by 1956, indeed by 1952, the MCP in Singapore had become irrelevant to the political process. It existed chiefly as rumour, imagination and propaganda. Special Branch consequently had difficulty substantiating its assertions. A report on Communist Front organisations in Singapore, prepared in advance of the 1956 constitutional talks, admitted that, quote, the degree of known MCP penetration of these organizations is comparatively small, unquote, and that the organizations were all merely suspected of being communist fronts. There was no proof. So, how to get around this lack of evidence? Well, to do so, Special Branch turned this position on its head by declaring that the lack of evidence was proof. It said in its reports that the lack of evidence showed that the organizations were following the MCP's 1951 directive to restrict itself to expanding and consolidating the labor and student movements and supporting the overall anti-colonial movement. This, consequently, allowed them to accuse anyone engaged in lawful anti-colonial activity of following MCP directives, and hence painted a broad picture of potential subversion and violence. And of course, it had the added advantage of being impossible to disprove. You can't disprove a negative. Thus, in his memorandum to the Council of Ministers, Director of Special Branch Alan Blades admitted that there was no evidence that the left-wing associations were under any MCP control, but declared that their behaviour was, quote, so remarkably similar that without independence of MCP penetration, the same conclusion that the MCP is responsible is inevitable, unquote. Or, to explain what he's saying, to put it another way, communists speak Chinese, left-wing leaders speak Chinese. Communists have black hair and brown skin, left-wing leaders have black hair and brown skin. Communists oppose the government, and left-wing leaders oppose the government. Therefore, left-wing leaders are communists. On such flimsy logic were lives destroyed. In his memo, Blade concluded by recommending the arrest of anyone who behaved like a communist. And to top it off, he did it in a particularly racist way and a slightly ungrammatical way. He wrote, quote, the Chinese population, through centuries of subservience, is particularly vulnerable to pressure methods. Until such time as a natural resistance can be built up, an extension of repressive measures to include detention or banishment of all who act in a communist manner, and this is underlined, act in a communist manner, whether connected with the MCP or not, is urgently essential. Triad is totally banned by law. Communist is just as ruthless and far more dangerous. Communist behavior should also be totally banned. So, Blades is basically saying anyone who acts like a communist should be arrested, detained without trial, banished. But what on earth does that mean? It's a blank check to arrest anyone who opposed the government. By the time Blades wrote this memo, the situation had grown acute for the British and their collaborators. The anti-yellow culture movement had broadened. On 19th August, 10 days before the Legislative Assembly reconvened, over 800 representatives from a wide range of organisations gathered at the Badminton Hall and voted to form an anti-yellow cultural council. The executive committee was carefully apportioned to be representative of Singapore. Representatives of 4 Malay, 4 Chinese and 2 Indian associations, 4 trade unions, 2 women's associations and 1 farmers association. the Anti-Yellow Cultural Council was organized into three main linguistic departments. The Chinese department, led by the Singapore Chinese Middle School Students Union, the Malay department, led by the Malay Cultural Association, and the English department, led by the Singapore Factory Shop Workers Union. They openly declared their aim was to raise political consciousness to fight for a free, independent, and democratic Malaya. The organization held events to protest and burn pornographic publications and protest against vice. This was Singapore's first anti-colonial association to transcend ethnic, class, occupation, gender, and political lines. It was the culmination of anti-colonial associationalism, the evolution of organizational methodology, the desire for left-wing unity, the spirit of multiracialism and self-determination espoused by Bandung. It was a deadly threat to colonial political and moral authority. And that's why it existed for barely a month before the government utilized internal security laws to destroy the movement and clamp down on extra-parliamentary politics in general, breaking the back of the anti-colonial movement and bringing an abrupt end to the flowering of democratic associationalism in Singapore. Join us next week when I detail how they did so. As always, if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit Patreon, patreon.com/pjthumb. Thank you very much and see you next week.